Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
The people's flag is deeper shred, it's shrouded off the mass of day. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Talking today with Len Krimmerman. He's philosophy professor here at UConn, and we're going to be talking about workplace democracy. Welcome, Len.
Welcome. Thank you.
You came in 1968, as I understand it, and a momentous time in our country, and I'm sure that...
Here, too.
I'm sure it helped shape your beliefs and experiences. You actually were involved in helping to set up a workers' cooperative in the 70s, I understand.
That's right, in Willimantic.
A chicken...
It was a chicken process. That was before I became vegetarian, and one of the reasons for it.
And when you got involved with that cooperative, were you already interested in cooperatives as a political movement?
Yes, I was. I had gone to a conference in the early 70s where Mondragon, the great Basque network of cooperatives, was described, and where someone who became a close friend of mine, George Bonello, talked about doing something similar here in the United States. So we set up an organization which had chapters in Connecticut, Boston, Philadelphia, Ithaca, Washington, and so on, to try to do something to replicate the Mondragon cooperatives. And the cooperative that I and others set up in Willimantic was an expression of that.
Now, Mondragon, we should mention, is a cooperative, a whole complex of cooperatives in the Basque region of Spain.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And has been going on since World War II.
Almost, yeah. It got started in the late 40s and then with a technical school. Mm-hmm. And then with several cooperatives in sort of high-tech at the time, durable goods, stoves, refrigerators, and so on. And by 1960, they had produced maybe 10 or 15 cooperatives, but it wasn't enough for the founder, Father Arizmendi, a very remarkable fellow. And he suggested that they set up a bank. Everybody else thought he was crazy. Banks are the problem, they said to him, but he held out. And now there is a bank. It's called the Bank of the People's Labor, that will actually loan funds to start new cooperatives and help old cooperatives if they need it. And they have close to 150 cooperatives, and they employ something like 50,000 to 75,000 people. Mm-hmm. And it's a marvelous...
The idea of cooperatives as a path of social and economic reform probably goes back a good 200 years. The Owenites, the other communalists who were popular in the United States. And then when the Marxist movement started to take off, those kinds of endeavors fell out of favor, or at least there were different factions within the socialist movement, some who thought that those were a good idea and some who thought they were a bad idea.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, we have information that we published in a book called When Workers Decide that showed that Ben Franklin supported a shoemaker's cooperative in Philadelphia in the late 18th century. These were people who didn't like the wages or conditions that they were being paid by their employers, and they quit and formed their own, called it a cooperative, and there were several of them. Mm-hmm. So it went back even before the 19th century.
Right.
But by the middle of the 19th century, yeah, there were groups that were somewhat suspicious of cooperatives because they sort of fell into the system that they were trying to change, the capitalist system. Mm-hmm. But they were still cooperative. The Knights of Labor in this country seemed to be both pro-labor and very supportive of cooperatives. Mm-hmm. There's evidence that they set up more cooperatives even than Mondragon.
Wow.
in the 30 or 40 years that they were involved. But then the labor movement with people like Gompers and others decided that labor really should be one thing and management another.
Mm-hmm.
And the role of labor was simply to advocate against management for better conditions, better wages, and forget all that about owning your own business.
Mm-hmm. A similar trajectory in Britain, where they had the Fabian movement, which advocated cooperativization, mm-hmm. and then they helped found the Labor Party, and then the Labor Party and trade unions went away from cooperativization.
Right, towards more, in some cases, national,
yeah,
nationalization that, and
right,
so on.
Yeah. Right. Well, there has been an American version of worker democracy, and the ESOP movement. Can you tell us a little bit about where the ESOP concept come from, and employee stock ownership plans?
Right.
Where did that come from?
It came from the Republican Party.
As all good ideas do, of course.
So with that in mind, you might wonder where it's going to go. But there was a Republican senator, I believe, who advocated this as a way to make everybody a capitalist. You know, I mean, we're in capitalism, why shouldn't everybody be an owner?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to get smiles from both sides of the aisle, and it went into law, giving companies who do start employee stock ownership plans certain kinds of tax breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a sort of a win-win situation. The company gains, the workers become owners, and in many cases, it's very just formality. Workers might own 10 or 12 or 15% of the company and have no voting rights. In other cases, I would say about 10% of the cases, you have majority ownership, you have democratic participation, you have a vote. You can run for and be on the board if you're a worker, et cetera. The estimates now, I think, are something like between 12 and 13,000 employee-owned firms. Of that total, maybe 1,500 are more majority-owned and, mm-hmm. and so on.
United Airlines is...
It's one of the largest, I think 57% owned by mm-hmm. Workers from two of the unions there.
Mm-hmm. And you have indicated some skepticism about these projects. Do you think that employee stock ownership plans are a model or a path towards the kinds of democratization that you imagine? They're not usually as politically inspired as the previous models have been. But
well, I think it's a mixed bag, and yet sort of you want to let 100 or maybe 1,000 flowers bloom and mm-hmm. so forth. And people now are using this in very creative and more democratic ways. For example, for many, many years, I've been trying to reach people in the anti-sweatshop movement and saying, look, I'm certainly not going to buy Nike sneakers, but where do I buy my sneakers?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to come from some sweatshop, mm-hmm. right? Maybe not Nike. And the answer is, yeah, I guess so. We don't know what to do. Maybe don't wear sneakers at all. But now there's something called TeamX, which is a worker-owned, union-based firm in Los Angeles that is going to come online, or has just come online, to make sports equipment and maybe sneakers and uniforms and so forth. So they're an ESOP.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be an ESOP because of the tax advantage. They don't want to just be a worker collective and so on, because those may not get that tax advantage.
Right.
So progressive people now can see that there is something to be gained through the ESOP movement, although I would have to say most of the ESOPs have not done much to increase the amount of real democracy available to their workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, this connects us to, by the way, we're speaking with Len Krimmerman. He's a philosophy professor at University of Connecticut and one of the editors of GEO, Grassroots Economic Organizing, Newsletter for Democratic Workplaces and Globalization from Below. And you say that when this newsletter first started, the focus was pretty much on workplace democracy. But as time has gone on, you've increasingly focused on economic globalization and economic justice issues. And this is one of the connections that you and I'm sure everybody else is making, is that It doesn't help just to have a worker cooperative here in your own town or in your own workplace. Why not trade with, in the third world, identify and trade with worker democracy movements there?
All over, right.
All over.
Yeah.
And we've got this coffee. Most people probably encounter this at the coffee stand. There's in many grocery stores, the fair trade coffee, and then the regular coffee, and the fair trade coffee comes from relatively democratically run cooperatives in various Latin American countries. Is that the kind of grassroots globalization that you're pressing for?
It's certainly one of the forms of that. And that can take, the fair trade movement can take many different forms. We were talking just before about this co-op that in Ecuador. A woman from there came up to stores with all sorts of crafts and artisan clothing and so forth that is, again, fair trade because they guarantee the cooperatives or the individual enterprise people a fair price for their products. But fair trade is only one part of the globalization from below. You have things where all over, there are pockets of cooperative resistance, such as the movement in Brazil, the Movimento Sem Terra, which has occupied tremendous amounts of land, hundreds of thousands of hectares, placed homeless and near homeless people on them, probably close to a quarter of a million, maybe more. And they have formed cooperatives, and they do trade, and now they've taken over a factory. I just read that on the internet as well. So the grassroots globalization or globalization from below has a remarkable number of different varieties.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 years ago, we had a visitor here from Hungary, Géza Varga, a friend of ours, and he has set up a cooperative organic network of farms and other enterprises outside of Budapest. And in order for them to succeed, they need to export. And we were trying to get his products accepted either by Northeast Co-ops or by United Naturals or other large firms. We're still working on that. But that's the idea of globalization from below, that we can trade throughout the entire world with a new form of economic enterprise. We don't have to buy from corporations that befoul the earth and exploit the people and destroy animals as well and so on.
Now, there's a two-part Marxist critique of the cooperative movement, and the first part is that capitalism concentrates capital. Everyone becomes an employee of big firms. Workers, because of their common exploitation, see their commonalities and join together to overthrow this, you know, this system. The other part is a critique of the utopian nature of the cooperative movement. As long as there's a global capitalist system, these small efforts at democratization, not only do they get in the way of the development of worker consciousness, but they also will never be successful. They will, because they won't be able to compete in a capitalist system. Do you, and of course, modern socialists have added a third critique, I think, which is that those few cases where workers do get to buy out their firm, they get to buy out the firms that are failing. Capitalists say, yeah, okay, fine, you can buy out the, you know, we haven't made a profit at this, but maybe we'll give the workers a shot at it. So it's kind of lemon socialism. I mean, isn't there some truth to those different critiques that workers, A, can become insular in enterprise consciousness, B, these firms have a really hard time making a go of it, and C, the only times they're really given an opportunity to buy out significant parts of capital is when capital's failed.
Right. Well, I think they all represent obstacles, but they're not ones that can't be overcome. And they're not ones that all forms of globalization from below necessarily have to confront. For example, the MST is in a way not part of the global marketplace. They want to make sure their own people get fed and so on, homes and decent schooling, which they all can provide right there. And many of the indigenous areas would be happy if they were just left alone. They don't need to export and compete with Nestle's or whatever. As far as the first thing and the insularity, Mondragon had the slogan, I think, that in the capitalist system, capital controls labor, but in the cooperative system, labor controls capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than capital being all of one sort, if labor can access capital and reproduce itself through more and more capital,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't matter that they're using capital, they can still do well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, insularity is a different matter, but Mondragon and others that I could mention have developed non-insular forms of cooperatives where,
mm-hmm.
In fact, the International Cooperative Alliance, one of the 10 principles of cooperativism is that cooperatives should help other cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and so where you find cooperatives that are insular or isolated or indifferent and so forth, they're sort of not being as cooperative as they should be.
Well, but that's more of a political, and in fact, of course, many cooperatives, both in Europe and the Third World, come out of a socialist movement and are mm-hmm. bound together by common commitments to socialism often. But to the extent that they are a firm, and to the extent that they are co-owners of a firm, then there's a certain inevitable dynamic to say mm. that, you know, maybe we'll have to let some people go, fire some people in order to compete. Mm. Maybe we'll have to undercut our even other cooperatives that we're competing against in order to make a living.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. And I think, again, if you look at Mondragon, you find that everybody is guaranteed a job in a cooperative, but not necessarily the one that you're in right now.
Mm. So there's lifetime employment, but
so, right, and so
not necessarily. Yeah,
your cooperative may have to lay off half a dozen people, but we'll find you, or we'll retrain you, and find you another place within mm-hmm. our system.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of non-isolated mm-hmm. effort, I think, means that you're not binding yourself to this one single cooperative. You'll work as hard as you can to get it to be successful. But should it be less than successful, you have somewhere else that you can go. And I think that if we combine cooperatives with other forms of enterprise where you don't have to depend on any one single firm or even one single type of firm, then I think we can overcome that enterprise consciousness. For example, again, in Quebec, they have what is called solidarity funds. And they're actually throughout most of the provinces, but the most highly developed ones are in Quebec. And these are based on giving individuals throughout Quebec tax breaks if they are willing to invest in these solidarity funds, or sometimes called labor-sponsored development funds. And again, those will allow people to shift around within the network of firms that are supported by the particular fund, provincial fund. You can find different employment if your firm should go under or need to cut back on labor.
I'm speaking with Len Krimmerman. He's a philosophy professor at the University of Connecticut, teaches political philosophy there, and he is also one of the editors of GEO, the Grassroots Economic Organizing Newsletter for Democratic Workplaces and Globalization from Below. You can find that at www.geonewsletter.org. Len, you're talking about these solidarity funds, and I think that one of the things that the socialist movement would say to, again, to the cooperative movement is, yes, we do believe in, or at least most socialists nowadays believe in workplace democracy, and not, maybe not always, but at least nowadays they do, and but that it requires a kind of combined state policy to support those enterprises. You know, that it should be a goal of society to say we want as much democracy as possible, and there's nothing sacrosanct about the way the market works. And just the same way we have laws regulating the kind of toxics you can be exposed to and the kind of wages that you can be paid, we should have laws that encourage and tax policies that encourage the growth of worker ownership. An example, I just want to get you to comment on this example, is the Swedish policy that was proposed by the Swedish Social Democrats in the late 1970s, early 80s, where they were going to set up stock ownership plans in the local areas to buy out all of the stock over a 30 or 40 year period, all the stock of the firms in those areas, and turn it over to worker and union run and community run cooperatives. And that plan, unfortunately, got put on a back burner after the Social Democratic government lost the next election. But that seemed to me like the ideal gradualist solution, both to socialism, the direct ownership of capital by working people, and to the cooperativization of an economy.
I would certainly support that idea in principle, and it's unclear what the best way to implement that is. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, that the provincial approach, which is based on government, because mm-hmm. it's the government that gives the tax break
right.
to the individual who invests
and passes the law, the stock ownership laws. And,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in that way, the government is saying we have a preference for these kinds of firms because they do give people more stability, they give people better job satisfaction, higher job satisfaction, and they're much just simply more of a democratic society will come out of this. Mm-hmm. And unless we move in that direction, and I think this is your point,
yeah.
It will retain its sort of marginal position. Workplace democracy will be something that people do voluntarily, and some successfully, some not so successfully, but it won't become mainstream unless there is a considerable, not just ESOPs, because ESOPs don't give tax breaks for workplace democracy,
right.
just ownership with maybe a little bit more
right.
Participation.
That's the Republican vision of cooperatives, is that,
right.
well, you create as many cooperatives as you want, you can do it, but you have to compete in the same market as everybody else. And I think those of us on the other side need to say, no, they don't have to compete on the same market as everybody else, because this is the kind of work people should have.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
just as the same, you know, just as we penalize firms that expose their workers to toxics, we should be penalizing firms that don't provide workplace democracy.
Right. And I think the first stage of that, because this country is so heavily capitalist, has to be, well, can these firms make it?
Mm-hmm.
And we now have, I think, in the years since I went to that conference about Mondragon, we have enough evidence that even without government support, cooperatives are able to make it. We mm-hmm. have a cooperative in New York City, in the Bronx, South Bronx, that has 600 members, almost all of whom are by choice owners. They don't have to be, but 500 or so are owners.
Mm-hmm.
They're all, or almost all, women over 40, minorities, have been on welfare. And this is the standard enterprise for home health care in New York City now.
Mm-hmm.
It has the highest hourly wages, the highest ratings by third parties and so forth and so on. It's replicating itself in Philadelphia. It's got a replication other places it's begun to replicate. Now, it got virtually no government support, and yet in the 17 years it's become successful and it's still going on. So now we can say, look, if we set up these things, they're not going to fail, and the government money that might have been put into them just lost and so forth. We have the evidence. Mm-hmm. But I think in this country, for various reasons that we could go into, to start from the point that we need state aid wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But now we can say, maybe on a state-by-state basis, look, here's a way of, you know, creating jobs in what would be otherwise high unemployment areas.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a way of salvaging some plants that might do well in the manufacturing area. And we have all kinds of other models, which I haven't mentioned, besides Mondragon.
Mm-hmm.
Mondragon is high-tech. It has robotics. It has durable goods. It has on-road, off-road vehicles, all made by cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have, in Italy, the Emilia-Romagna phenomena, which is a different way of putting together a different sort of economy where you have flexible manufacturing networks of small computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacture that have been very, very successful. So there are all sorts of ways of doing this that don't that get beyond the hierarchical corporate model as the only way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Friend of mine, actually, in one of the editors of GEO, works in a company called About Change, which is made up of a dozen highly sophisticated computer consultants. Now, they are not a cooperative, but they work cooperatively. Like each employee is a individual or independent contractor. He has to go out or she has to go out and find their own clients. But when they get a client, they bring the whole thing back to the rest of the enterprise and utilize the skills that are quite different among the other people.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Alex has tremendous skills in setting up web pages and all that sort of stuff, but he doesn't know much about business plans.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else does that in the firm. So it's a mix of a cooperative and individual entrepreneur model.
Mm-hmm.
We are now in consultation
mm-hmm.
with a group called NASRO, which I think is very interesting because it's the National Association of Socially Responsible Organizations
mm-hmm.
that calls itself an anarcho-syndicalist organization because it's full of progressive entrepreneurs that have bolted from the corporate sector, 50,000 members, and they want to join in with cooperative movement. So we have lots of different ways in mm-hmm. which this new economy could take shape.
I've been speaking with Len Krimmerman. He's one of the editors of GEO, the grassroots economic organizing newsletter for democratic workplaces and globalization from below. You can find it at geonewsletter.org. Thanks for joining us, Len.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.